there. This is Gail Weisberg, interviewer, respondent Ruth Livingston, June 16, 1986, Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Ruth, would you please give your name and address and phone number, please?
I'm Ruth Livingston, 5100 Fifth Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA, 15232.
Terrific. Okay. Ruth, I understand that you were not born in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And we are interested in your Pittsburgh contributions. So we will just start briefly with your early life, and if you would tell us a little bit about your father, mother, siblings, and where you grew up.
I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, as was my brother, as was my father, and my mother, all come from Chicago. And I grew up in a perfectly normal, middle-class neighborhood. There was nothing very interesting about my childhood.
Okay. Would you mind telling us your birth date?
Sure, I'd mind. May 11th, 1917.
Okay, thank you. In your home, could you tell us a little bit about the atmosphere of the home, maybe the religious aspect or the economic aspect of growing up?
Mm-hmm. We went to Sunday school. We went to Reform Jewish Sunday school because my mother had been raised in the Reform temple. So I was, and her mother and father had been Reform Jews, not in Chicago, but where they were born, in Germany. And so they always went to that temple after coming to America. And the home was reasonably religious. I knew all about every holiday. I was very carefully instructed about these things. I knew very little about the Orthodox faith, and I don't even know if there was much of a conservative organization then. But that was the extent of my knowledge. But I knew about the Bible, and I knew what was in the Bible, and I went faithfully to Sunday school, and I was confirmed when I was 13 years old.
Okay. I think I should have asked you, what was your maiden name?
Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-A-N.
Okay. And you spell your name now?
L-I-V-I-N-G-S-T-O-N.
Thank you. How could you contrast Chicago with Pittsburgh?
Especially when I came here in 1943.
Yes.
Well, Chicago is a big bustling city. It's number two. And Pittsburgh is a small non-bustling city. And it was even smaller then and seemed to me very strange because it was so very different than Chicago. The kinds of buildings, the way people lived. I had never thought that a big city, and this I thought would be a big city, could have so few apartment buildings. But when I went looking for an apartment, I found that an apartment in Pittsburgh is the second floor of somebody's home that he's converted. And sometimes you have to go right through his front door. And so there was a big change, and there certainly was a change in accent. I wasn't accustomed to the way people in Pittsburgh spoke, so that the first time I went out to buy some milk, and I went in the store and asked for a carton of milk, the man assured me milk didn't come in cartons, only Coke did. So because then you only had bottles, and we had lots of little things to get used to. But I was overwhelmed by the hospitality, and the friendliness, and the kindness of people here.
When you came here in 1943, mm-hmm. Why did you come to Pittsburgh?
My husband was sent here by the firm he worked for then. The steel company.
And what was your husband's name?
David Livingston.
And then when had you married him? Can you tell us a little bit about your courtship and marriage?
This is going to be an X-rated tape if you're not careful. We were married in 1938, which was the Depression.
Uh-huh.
He was a young lawyer, very bright, very poor. And so after a few years of marriage and after having a baby, and realizing that genteel poverty is okay for two adults, it doesn't work for babies, so he left and he got into the steel business. He went to work for a steel company in Chicago. We sent him here.
I see. And then when you came here, what was the name of the company that brought you here?
He worked at that time for Century Steel, which bought a warehouse here in Pittsburgh that was completely empty. He was sent here to staff it, to stock it, and to make it work, and he did. And that was called XL Steel on Behan Street on the north side.
Did you sell XL?
XL, EXCEL. XL Steel.
Where was it?
On the north side, on Behan Street. Behan. We moved to Mount Lebanon when we first came here.
I see.
Because I didn't know one person, nor did he. He knew nobody, and I knew nobody at all in this whole town. And who do you talk to? You ask the waitress in the restaurant or the cab driver, and where's a nice place to live? And people said, Mount Lebanon. They have a good school system. And so we went out there immediately.
Tell us about his jobs and setting up your home and raising your children. You had more than one son.
I have three sons.
Tell us a little bit then, starting with the jobs that you took you on.
Well, he worked for XL Steel, as I say, and was there for many years. Until he decided if he could make that much money for that company, he could make even more for himself. And he did, and went into business himself. Eventually, he and Sidney Feldman became partners with Tygart Steel in the Keysport. Mm-hmm. And you'll still, you will, although the company is now gone, you can still see evidences of Tygart in the museum. There are contributions from Tygart Steel. And it's gone now. That's all.
Yes. Tell us about setting up your house or your houses that you had when you were in Mount Lebanon.
I found that this was 1943, and you will have no knowledge of this, but that was during the war, and apartments were very, very scarce all over. In Chicago, it was very common in renting apartments for the landlord to say to you, if you rent the apartment, you must buy this furniture, which consisted of a broken old bridge table and two chairs. And this furniture costs $800. And people would say, oh, yes, yes, I'm desperate. I need that furniture. That's wonderful. And there was no such thing in Pittsburgh. There was no money under the table. Everybody in Pittsburgh was really very honest and upfront, which impressed me. But there weren't many apartments to rent, not real apartments. And we did find this one in Mount Lebanon. And it was a sublet, and we got it. And I lived there in Mount Lebanon in the apartment until the second child was born, when it was getting a little too cozy. So we moved into a little house. We had never, either of us, lived in a home. We didn't know how it would work. But we figured we'd try it, so we bought a small house, and we lived there very happily. Same thing happened. Another son. We got pushed out of the small house and into a big one, where we spent the rest of our years, until the whole process reversed itself, and the house gradually emptied out.
Right.
So the big house got smaller, just as, in reverse, the other houses had, no, the big house got bigger
right.
as the small houses had gotten smaller.
Right. So you had three sons.
I have three
sons. You have three sons. Can you tell us a little bit about raising your three boys?
Well, I'm sure we did a marvelous job. I think we did. They're very nice men.
What are their names and age today?
Skip Livingston is, he was born in 42, is 44 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Livingston is 42, and Jack Livingston is 38.
Mm-hmm.
We raised them according to Dr. Spock and the best we could, you know? And everybody tried to be a good mother, and it wasn't always easy.
Right.
The first child was an extraordinarily gifted child in that he could read by the time he was 2 years old, and I mean really read. And 2.5, 3 years old, if you handed him any book, Shakespeare, whatever, he may not understand it, but he could read every word. And he taught himself, which was, and we didn't even realize how extraordinary that was because he was our first. We thought maybe that's how they make him. He now lives in Hopewell, New Jersey, and works in Princeton for ETS, Educational Testing Service, and he does educational research and scientific statistics and things I really don't understand, but he does them well, and he's an authority, whatever it is that he does. The other one, Jay, now lives in New York City. He's a sociologist with Montclair State College in Montclair, New Jersey, and the third one, Jack, has just recently come to Livingston Steel from California to work here.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
When you came to Pittsburgh, tell us a little bit about your social life, maybe your family vacations, your hobbies, what religion, where, what
Well, I guess that makes it what Temple or synagogue might have been affiliated with.
Well, in the beginning, neither my husband nor I was very religious, mm-hmm. nor did we ever become religious. I'm as close to being a card-carrying atheist, I think, as anybody else in the National Council of Jewish Women. When I went to Israel, I remember being so thrilled when I found Israel was full of Jewish atheists. I thought, no wonder they call themselves, this is where I belong, that's all, you know. So religion did not then play a big part in our lives. But I always, always identified as Jewish, never let it be thought that I was anything but Jewish, always contributed to Jewish charities and all the organizations. In the first few months, I knew nobody at all. My husband called me up every day. And if I got a call a second time during the day, I knew it was the wrong number.
Because there was nobody there to call me.
And I made a lot of friends since then, uh-huh. because Pittsburgh is also
high. Well, you were very involved in your community, I understand, in Mount Lebanon, weren't you?
Yes, but not immediately.
Well, what
not in the first two or three years.
When you became involved in the community, tell us a little bit about what you did.
Well, we were beginning to, first, after we lived here a couple of years and I began to meet people who lived in Squirrel Hill, they said, you can't live in Mount Lebanon. Jews don't live in Mount Lebanon. Well, I assured them that this Jew did. Mm-hmm. And eventually we did meet some other Jewish families in Mount Lebanon. They were the pioneers.
Yes. Tell us about
I was always, quickly after coming here, I became a member. And then we decided in council to try forming a chapter or a branch mm-hmm. in Mount Lebanon, in the South Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And I was the first president to serve more than a month or two. There was a president, I don't remember what happened to her, but then I was really the first president of that.
Do you remember what year?
No, never mind.
About how old were your children then?
It had to be, I really can't tell you. If I'd known you were going to ask me, I would have looked it up some way. I have the charm bracelet that they gave, you know, for my bracelet that they gave me when I left office. And the year
were
is
your boys in school, out of school?
Oh. I know that this must have been, maybe 48, 49, something like that, I
okay.
think. I'm not
uh-huh.
really sure. But I know that it was very, very good for all of the people who in any way were touched by council. That chapter was good for them. Some of the people, some of our members, had mothers and fathers living with them who thought they were the only older people, because Mount Lebanon looks like such a homogeneous neighborhood. Everybody looks like everybody else, and everybody is sort of the same age as everybody else. And so they thought there were no older people. Well, we found out that there were mothers and fathers of the members, and so we formed a senior citizens group and did good things for them, and worked with some of the organizations in the South Hills. Exactly which ones we helped, but they were all located out there
mm-hmm.
and we rendered services there. I know we did work at the school for handicapped children in Brookline, and our members worked there on a volunteer basis, either in the library or whatever tasks we were assigned. And so we made our presence felt in a very positive way.
Well, I know that the organization has continued on.
Oh, yeah.
Grayson,
mm-hmm.
after you were president, what kind of a position did you have with council? How did you maintain your being active with them?
After I was no longer president, I continued on the board, and I'm sure I did whatever they asked of me. I remember being head of the speakers. That was the program department,
mm-hmm.
I guess, then. I did that, and I also was on the board of council in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't remember anything very specific that we did. I know we had a group, and I think it was called the Public Affairs Group. I'm not sure what we called ourselves anymore. But we met once a month and had a speaker. But when did we meet? On a Saturday night with our husbands. And we met in the homes of the members.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember having a speaker there one night from Pittsburgh. He said that was mind-boggling. He said, how can you get a bunch of young people to come out and listen to a speaker on a Saturday night and enjoy it? And that's exactly what we did. Interesting speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Husbands were as interested as the wives. And that was a good group. And I really don't remember all the things we did because that was so many lifetimes ago.
Well, how did you get involved in your business today as you are? You may have to.
I did that the hard way. I did that the hard way because of my husband's death. I knew nothing at all about business ever. What I did in my other life was to write. I was a copywriter, wrote for ad agencies on a freelance basis, and sometimes would work for an ad agency for 6-8 months on special assignments, never willing to work full time because the culture at that time thought women's place was at least sometimes in the home, and having a career was all right if it didn't interfere with your chief duties. And I always thought that if I didn't give my husband breakfast every morning before he left, he'd drop dead. And now we know how many husbands aren't given breakfast. They don't drop dead at all. They survive just fine. But it was not the thing that one did. And I always wanted to be home when my kids came home from school. And that was very important. So when they came in and said, hi, Mom, I could say hi.
Right.
And that was the extent of what I gave them. Because they were in and out and off to the schoolyard, the basketball court, you know.
Right.
But I felt that so that my work was very little, even when I started, when they got older and I started going out to work. I liked working at home, picking up my assignments and taking them home.
Who did you work for?
Everybody. I did some work for Barry Farnell, for Jay Rich, for Cavanaugh Morris Agency. Those are the big ones that I did most of the work for.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote a newspaper column once a week in a small neighborhood paper called The Revere.
The Revere,
as in Paul Revere.
Right.
And I wrote a column every week, and it was called I Presume.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed doing that. And then
what did you write on?
Whatever I wanted to.
Okay.
And there was no censorship at all. I wrote whatever interested me, and they were interesting columns.
Do you have any of those columns?
Sure.
Possibly we could put in with this package.
Sure. I do. I saved them. That's not very modest, but I did.
Maybe you could make us some photocopies,
mm-hmm.
and we would love to insert them.
All right. Some of them were cute and lively.
Just give us a sampling. It would be very nice to insert them.
I'd be proud to do that.
Thank you. We would like that. All right. You were telling us.
And then, in 1973, my husband died.
How old of a man was he?
58. And that's really not old enough to die. I remember, you know, when we were driving, one of the things we used to do in Mount Lebanon was drive the senior citizens to wherever it was they were going, a picnic or a meeting or something, and then all the members would help by driving them. And I would drive, and I would listen to the ladies talking, and they would say, when my husband died, he was only 73, or he was only 80, or he was only, whatever it was, only was the word that prefaced his age. And I realized they could have said my husband was only 180. It would have still been too soon for them. So I think of them when I say that David was only 58, that that really was too young to go. Prior to his death, maybe 10 months before, he had told me that he would like to think that that he was building up a good business, and he would like to turn it over to someone when he died. Kids aren't interested, and they most certainly were not. He said, so I'd like to turn it over to you. I said, great. He said, so I will start teaching you the business. Oh, I got all excited, and I had commitments until May. But after that time, I decided I'd come in. You know, I had the whole fantasy. I would come downtown and have lunch, and it would be so exciting. We'd have lunch together, and I could shop and see all the excitement of the downtown world. Starting in May, however, he never lived to that May, so he never did have
was
a chance.
Was he sick when he said this to you?
He was never sickly. He was always appeared to be a robust, very substantial man. But actually, he had troubles that went many years back. When he was 28 years old, he wanted to buy insurance, and they turned him down, and they sent the report to his doctor. I was pregnant at the time, so it was my doctor. He was a family doctor. And the doctor told me the report, and they said that he had more albumin in his urine than some old men with dropsy, and that his blood pressure was startlingly high, and all in all, Metropolitan Insurance Company didn't give him 1 year to live. So that was what he was told at 28. Now, so he cheated him out of 30 years. So if you look at it that way, it wasn't so bad. And he lived a very exciting life. Along the way, he had terrible things happen to him. He had a stroke once he nearly bled to death. He had a couple of heart attacks, but would always recover and never seem like a sick man. But of course, the kidneys took a beating, the heart took a beating, you know, it was all very bad. It all stemmed from rheumatic heart as a child.
What you decided that you, and you had talked to him about coming into the business, mm-hmm. He was going to prepare you, and your husband passed on, and then what did you do?
When David died, I had already told him, yes, I would do that, although nobody thought it was going to happen that soon. He didn't think he was going to die, and I certainly didn't. And so, maybe 2 weeks after his death, I started coming in here. There were checks to be signed.
You came to this office?
Well, to one in this building.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Uh-huh. And they said, sign these checks. And I signed those checks so that we could pay bills. And there he had a salesman working for him at that time. Mm-hmm. And I came in every day, and I worked. And I learned. I had never seen a ledger in my life. I didn't know what a ledger was. He opened it and they showed me what a ledger is. I remember either the accountant or the lawyer said, you really should discount all your bills. I said, sure, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it meant to discount a bill.
So you learned under fire.
And they said, well, if you pay your bills within 10 days, you can take 0.5%. That was the standard deduction in the industry at that time. And I said, oh, sure, fine. How do I figure that? How do I know 0.5%?
That's where you were.
That.
Behind.
That's really nursery school economics, but that's where I was.
So we should say we are in the Frick building right now, in your office.
Yes, you are.
So you were in another office
in
within
the Frick
building.
Mm-hmm.
In downtown.
That was my
Pittsburgh.
Husband's office. Uh-huh. And he always had an office in a suite of lawyers. He rented space. He himself was a lawyer. A graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, as I told you in the beginning. It was very nice. I don't know of anybody else who has this kind of an arrangement, really. Throughout the country, I don't know anyone else.
Uh-huh.
But it's worked well for us, uh-huh. For me, certainly.
Uh-huh. Well, then tell us, you started to work in the business
mm-hmm.
in 1973.
Mm-hmm. That I did. In February
1930.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I came to work every day, and I worked as hard as I could and did the best I could and cried all the way home every night. And people said to me, why do you drive? Why don't you take the bus in town? You live right on a bus route. The bus stops in front of your door. Well, how could I take the bus home when I knew I had to cry all the way home? And I did every night. I thought, I will never learn this business. I'll never do what I'm supposed to do. That was all in addition to normal grief. The day when you lose the most important year.
Did you need to work at this point to support your boys?
No. No, I did not. One boy was married and the other was at work. And no, they were all out of the house at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them.
So you were really keeping the business?
I was continuing
husband.
The business because I wasn't sure whether or not I could get along financially. And I liked eating and paying the mortgage and wearing clothes. So, and of course, at the time, I knew I wanted to do this because I had said I would.
Person who keeps your word.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Why don't you fast forward the tape, Edris, and then we'll just go to the other side. Go over to the end.
You still have a lot.
That's all right. And then we won't have to.